Everybody ready? Missing Alana, but I think we'll go ahead. Back on the record, it's about 10:10. Mr. Sanderson.
Thank you, Your Honor. At this time, we would call Darcy Nigam to the stand.
Mr. Nigam, you've been here before, and I think you heard the perjury admonition this morning?
Yes, I did.
Okay. Please raise your right hand. You promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
I do.
Thank you. Mr. Sanderson.
Thank you. Mr. Nigam, could you please state your full name and business address for the record?
Darcy John Nigam, and my business address is 400 North 4th Street, Bismarck.
And who are you employed by?
Montana Dakota Utilities.
And what is your position with Montana Dakota Utilities?
I am the Director of System Operations and Planning.
And could you briefly describe what that entails?
So it entails the oversight of the operation of our transmission department from an operation standpoint and market operations, and also I'm responsible for the load forecasting and resource planning activities for the company.
And Mr. Nigam, could you provide us with a brief background of your education and work history?
I have a bachelor's of science degree in electrical engineering from North Dakota State University, and also a master's of business administration from the University of Mary. And I've been employed by Montana Dakota Utilities and the MDU Resources family of companies for 20 years.
And Mr. Nigam, have you prepared PowerPoint slides regarding your areas of testimony today?
Yes, I have.
And what subject areas are addressed by your testimony?
I will talk about the need and the timing for the Lewis and Clark reciprocating engine projects.
And using your PowerPoint slides, can you explain how MDU determined there was a need for this project?
Yes, I can. So the needs that we had for the Lewis and Clark Rice projects determined in two ways, one from a resource adequacy standpoint and the other one for reliability concerns we have up in the Bakken region. The resource adequacy needs we showed in our 2000 integrated resource plan, and I'll show a slide on that and also the results of that resource plan in one of my next slides. Reliability concerns that we have, and I'll talk about that in my slides as well, is the transmission dependency that we have on Western Area Power Administration and Basin Electric up in the Bakken areas. One of the other challenges that we've struggled with up in the Bakken area is the continuing increase in the rural electric co-op's forecasts, and I'll show what impacts that has on us as well as in our transmission planning and operation. One of the things that we foresaw for this current winter season, 2015-2016, was a real risk or threat as far as having inadequate transmission available up into the pocket, not only on a contingency basis, but also under system attack conditions, which led to the potential for load curtailments of customers. And I'll talk about some of the mitigation efforts that we've gone through over the years to try to lessen any impacts or how we had perceived any threats for curtailments, how we were trying to mitigate those. This is a slide from our 2003 Integrated Resource Plan. It shows our peak demand obligations, which are the stack bars. It's the blue colors. The red lines indicate what our committed generation resources were, contract purchases from others. Just as an example, you can see in 2014 to 15, you can see that our generation resources credit amount drops. That's the expiration of the purchase agreement that we had with We Energies. And then in 2015, we had the addition of the Heskett 3 generation resources, so it's the swapping of those. But we continued to see, based upon our growing load forecast, the continued need for capacity resources in the future. This next slide is a summary of the modeling results that we had for the 2013 Integrated Resource Plan. We had a couple of different base cases, one that was assuming the retirement of the Lewis and Clark facilities as we were exploring MATS compliance. And the other one is the optimal resource case, where we had selected the Lewis and Clark MATS project. At this point, it was a baghouse, plus we also showed the need for some internal combustion engines, which would be very similar to what the Rice projects were. And we also had another case where we looked at the difference in resource adequacy requirements. In 2013, we were still using the 90% coincidence factor for what our obligations were, and we ran a separate sensitivity for an 80% requirement, which is what our current was. In that, you can still see we're showing the need for the internal combustion engines. It just happens to be out, you know, a year later in the future. But in all of those cases, we are showing at least the need, as you can see, for additional capacity resources that we did have. As a part of our a PI meeting we had in front of this commission in 2013, we talked about some of the challenges that we had with growth in the Bakken. Some of that, the timing of that growth and how rapid it was consuming a lot of the flexibility that we had in our system. That flexibility was making it challenging to schedule outages and to do maintenance on the system. And we were really rolling into what we were calling system intact transmission capability in that area, which means that, you know, with all the facilities in service, you know, there was a certain amount of load that could be served, you know, reliably. Under various contingencies, it would mean that there would be less capability to serve load from the transmission system, and we would have had to rely on other means. And I'll talk about what some of those were. We also foresaw the increase in our load forecasts and the demands from the Bakken, you know, of estimating at least that our customers' electric consumption and in the communities we serve would likely double within the next 2 to 3 years. And I think we've been on pace to see that in the majority of the communities we serve. Withstanding all of that, of all of the growth in the Bakken, at that point we were estimating we were getting about 10% of all of the total growth. And we think that's still a fair case as far as getting 10% of less of all the growth that's gone on out there. In some areas, it certainly is a lot less than 10% that we've seen growth in. I want to point just back to another study that was occurring in the same time, and this was the study that was commissioned as a part of the North Dakota Industrial Commission and was a load forecast study that Cattermas, Lee, and Jackson performed that MDU and Basin Electric were a part of. Part of that was to help look at, you know, some of the direct drivers, which were oil production locations, and come up with help as far as on forecasts and where the growth was expected to occur. One of the things we were seeing at the time, you know, was certainly the increase in housing demands, which is important to us in our forecasting. You know, we don't serve the wells directly or the pumping loads. We end up serving the communities. So it's either it's the secondary growth you started to get, you know, what's the impact from people, what's the impact on residential, you know, small commercial industrial customers are really where we've seen the majority of our growth. And a lot of that is tied back to housing. So these were some of the important pieces for us to see. One point this graph had is it had the gold stack bar, certainly is the temporary housing, which was taken care of in the man camps. And I think as we've seen, there's been a shift of that, which is from man camps to permanent housing to the place that it's, you know, largely reduced. And in that permanent housing are the customers that we're serving. So at least initially, maybe we weren't getting man camps. We're now seeing those permanent housing customers and the other growth that goes along with that. One of the other drivers in that forecast was looking at number of well counts that were out there. Some numbers that I saw, at least in the director's cut, were the last numbers for number of wells currently operating in the state. And I think in October, November of last year, it was around 13,100. So if you take a look from that, it pretty much matches. If you go to where 2015 is 16, to where these forecasts are, it's right about in that 13,000 wells as far as on what would at least even be under the low growth scenario. One of the other drivers that was a part or outputs of the study was looking at increases in megawatt demand, and that would be from an entire area, not the subset that's just that Bakken region. One of the things we've seen, at least from 2012 to current, is an increase probably of about 600 megawatts or more up in that Williston load pocket. Majority of that, again, is not ours. It's the 10% number. But we have seen a significant increase from what in 2012 had a peak demand. And this is North Dakota in that Bakken study of, you know, 974 to at least adding, at least in the Williston area, another 600 megawatts of load. And a lot of that is correlated back just to the number of wells and the corresponding loads that go with that for pumping and gas processing was all a part of that study. And these were just a few of the heat maps that were prepared as part of the study just to show where was expected majority of the growth would occur. I would say that the majority of the growth we've seen in the Bakken, you know, certainly is in the major communities we serve, you know, those that end up being in Williston, you know, Tioga, Watford City. You know, we've also seen a significant amount of growth even as far south as Dickinson and also even into Sidney, Montana. But a lot of these, you know, graphs that they had on these heat graphs just showed where it was expected, you know, the load was going to fill in. From our transmission system, we talk about being dependent on Western Area Power Administration, Basin Electric. This is showing a map, and these were the facilities that were in service in 2012. The different colors that are part of this map, this ends up being that northwest part of North Dakota. Lines that are in gray are 115 kV lines. The blue lines end up being 230 kV lines, and then these red ones are 345 kV lines. So the lines that exist, and this is what's defined as the Williston load pocket by Western Area Power Administration for their reliability concerns, the only lines that we actually own are the ones that are highlighted in yellow, and those are all 115 kV lines. So this is why we say when we're dependent on Western Area Power Administration and Basin Electric, we're dependent upon their facilities to get up into the region, in which case we have facilities, you know, that serve our customers up there. You know, and a lot of that goes back to how we historically put together our transmission system together with them and just the incremental investments that were made over the years, either through our agreements with Western or Basin in the common use agreement that we had. One thing I'll point out on this, when we talk about why didn't MDU consider building its own transmission, you know, we would have had to build out to other facilities that were outside of this region that are MISO. That largely takes you down to either where Dickinson is or over into where the Buell area is, we'd have to build facilities up into this area if we did not want to be transmission dependent upon Western and Basin. And certainly that would not be cost effective, you know, for us to build new facilities based upon the level of growth that we were seeing compared to everyone else. One of the other things that we kept monitoring an eye on are certainly forecast projections that Western Area Power Administration was putting together, the timing as the Bakken growth was occurring, and at least leading up to the decisions that we're making regarding the rice units at Lewis and Clark. This is a forecast that Western had put together with information from transmission customers in the area. This is a much broader area than what is that Bakken area that I kind of showed in that shaded region. But it does show at least the load forecasts in 2012, how they were expected to kind of increase more rapidly, kind of level off, and then get into more of historic growth. What these blue lines represent are the load serving capabilities, system intact, based upon certain transmission projects that were planned to be developed by Western and Basin. The dashed line indicates at least where it appeared that the baseline load forecasts were coming in. So at least at this point, it appeared even with the growth and the transmission plans in place, there was adequate transmission to serve all of the load in that area. Fast forwarding a year, kind of as the Bakken starts to take off and the growth is much more rapid than what was forecasted, we come into the place. This is the end of 2012. We can end up seeing the star represents what the actual loads were in the pocket, not as a forecast, where they actually were coming in. The black lines indicate system intact transmission capability. So the pocket had enough transmission capability to serve this much load. And so if the load is greater than that, you have to have some mitigation. And what these red lines indicate is at least support from generation, particularly new is how Western looked at that, to support that load serving in that area. So these are largely the additions that Basin was making because they had the load growth of Culbertson, Pioneer, and what they were doing at Lonesome Creek. And that was maintaining a margin based upon the forecast. You know, this shaded area in green, transmission capability in black, and what the capability is in red with generation. And that's under peak condition. So we're talking peak conditions in the winter of what the capability of the system was. So at this point, we were still comfortable that there were at least plans in place, some of the mitigation activities that we had, you know, that we could still pursue, you know, with just the current programs we had. And I'll talk about what those are. Some of the things we had been doing, and again, one of the things Basin, or I should say Western, created that was a part of this graph here is they created a new class of transmission service. So rather than offering firm service or non-firm, they created a less than firm. So they wanted to continue to charge transmission customer for firm-like service. The less than firm was if you did not adequately, you know, forecasted your load, got it in soon enough so they could build facilities, they would consider it to be in a first tier that one would either be curtailed or have to be mitigated if there was a transmission problem. And a lot of that less than firm is the difference between what the forecast is and what ends up being these areas, at least in gray, that they could serve under a firm basis. So in creating this less than firm service, you know, we pursued various mitigation efforts, at least over the last couple years, to minimize any potential exposure to our customers for curtailments or put other agreements in place. One of those we did for the winter season of 2012-2013, we participated in an import service purchase with Basin from Manitoba Hydro. That purchase was only available because of some of other Basin's other arrangements they had. They offered it to us because we had some less than firm responsibility for that winter season, and at least, you know, they were looking for us to help pay for that kind of as an insurance policy. So if needed and if available from Manitoba Hydro, they could have scheduled some imports, at least in the absence of not having sufficient generation or to respond to a transmission outage. We also looked to expand our demand response and programs from the company that we had. You know, we took our C-Power Constellation commercial demand response program and really tried to roll it out hard in the Bakken area to find customers who had standby generation that they'd be willing, you know, in emergencies or certain situations to run that. So at least they would become the first ones in a demand response to curtail. We also looked at the placement of mobile generation up there, you know, which we relied upon for a couple winter seasons. So we had, you know, 3 2-megawatt diesel units, which are still up there, which, you know, a couple of the seasons we actually ran those, you know, a fair amount, at least to reduce peak loading on some of our facilities. We also, at least in the last two winter seasons, so that would be for 2013 and 14 and the 2014-2015 winter season, did enter into a redispatch service agreement with Basin Electric. You know, Western was giving them credit for the new generation they built, not our generation that had been there forever, you know, at Lewis and Clark Station in the area, but gave them credit for that new generation as a means to mitigate this less than firm responsibility they had. So we entered into agreements with them where we would purchase, similar to what a transmission congestion service would be, that if they got into one of these less than firm modes, or at least mitigation efforts were called upon, which they have been quite frequently the last several years, just because load has been above what the firm capabilities of the system are, there's a cost that Basin has to run their generation, and we agreed through a mechanism to reimburse them for those fuel costs, similar to what congestion would be, almost in a redispatch. One of the caveats of that was Basin offered that to us, but it was dependent upon available generation they had. So our customers would be the last served, and they would also be the first to be curtailed if there was not adequate generation that they would have. And of looking at what our firm transmission, you know, rights were, the mitigation we had through demand response and our mobile generation, and how much we had exposure for the firm transmission limits, we were kind of comfortable to continue to ride that out. Otherwise, the alternatives were for us to build new transmission or put generation in that area. And we saw the long-term solution, at least for that area, was Basin's construction of their 345 kV transmission line, at least providing additional load support into that area. One of the things that continued to happen, though, this whole time is at least the continued increase in the REC load forecasts, not our forecasts. You know, we went through a detailed study in the spring of 2012. We saw this growth, and we went community by community, you know, with our region folks, what was out there, what were potentials, and came up with a forecast that actually has held very well since that spring of 2012. In this timing of 1 year from 2012 to 2013 now, this is the indication, not officially, we were starting to see, is this is a potential load forced increase, you know, based upon other loads that are potentially out there that the co-ops were seeing. We start to end up seeing between the black lines and the red lines, there's a lot less margin. And in certain places, there are places where it looks like, you know, there may not be adequate, you know, generation system intact to serve the load that's out there. you know, still through some of the mitigation efforts that we had and we saw, we were still fairly comfortable, you know, to continue to ride through with the redispatch agreement that we had with Basin. And also this ends up being the addition of their 345 kV transmission line. You know, once they would get to all the way to Neset, you know, at least there would be at least sufficient margin on the transmission system, 2015 to 16, that at least, you know, we would have restored some of the margin and load serving capabilities. But fast forwarding again, this is April of 2013 to July of 2014. We start to hear from Basin and Western that we've got to talk to you again. And in that, they showed us this graph here, which it goes back to the forecast that were prepared in 2014, where in that vintage of the 2014 forecast for the REC load, they expected the gold line for growth. It comes to their 2013 forecast they put together, which is the red line. They keep seeing additional growth. And when they did their most recent update, this would be in 2014, we see there's even more growth that they're expecting out there. And again, this whole while, our load forecasts aren't changing. But yet, as transmission dependent as we are, you know, we're tied to, you know, the load serving capabilities in the pocket and this criteria that Western created for less than firm service. So at least looking at a capability, similar sort of thing. These are the load forecasts, July 2014. The black line is what the transmission system was capable of. The red line shows with generation what can be served. You can see it kind of does. There is still a glide path that you can kind of get to one of the 345 lines to the next 345 line, and then at least to the additional loop that kind of goes along the lake up there. One of the concerns gets to be is this project right here, this AVS to Neset, the 345, and if it gets done in time. And again, this is July of 14. And the other one they were showing us is in here is if those 345 lines are delayed or if the load forecast would increase additionally, you know, we get into the place as early as the winter of 2016 or even with generation that's available, you know, we can't serve all the load system intact. Under contingencies, it'd be even worse as far as load capabilities. But system intact, you know, there may be situations where we can't serve all the load up there. So we had conversations about potential, you know, partnering in new generation, other things that could be done for this winter season. You know, from a standpoint of, you know, Basin's position up there, they were looking, you know, of putting all their eggs kind of in one basket for the 345 line to get that done. You know, their next generation tranche they were looking at could only occur as fast as this summer of 2016. You know, some of the places they were looking at developing, and we talked to them about partnerships, you know, didn't work for us for locations because of access to transmission on others' facilities up there, that we made the decision that in order to prevent, you know, curtailments of customer load, if this project would be delayed. The other one that happens is even if this project has been put in service, as soon as you have an outage to this facility or some other facilities, the capabilities all drops back down to where it was last year. And so we saw ourselves not having sufficient resources, particularly for this coming winter season we're in, if this project was delayed or there were some sort of transmission problems up in that area. So in absence of being able to partner for some new projects up there, you know, and in the absence of being able to build new transmission, where if we look at transmission, we would have had to build back to either Buell or Dickinson for a MISO facility. You know, the costs of 115 or 230 kV lines are either $500,000 to $1 million a mile. And it doesn't take too long to see that that would cost more than $100 million. Mm-hmm. And also, we wouldn't be able to get it done in the time frame that was necessary. So unable to do any sort of partnerships, you know, to get economies of scale for this coming winter season, we looked at building our own generation. One of the other comments that I'll make is at the very bottom, you know, of just kind of getting into conversations with Southwest Power Pool, how the seams were going to work up there, redispatch abilities. We weren't quite sure if we even could continue some sort of redispatch agreement with Basin, if it would even be allowed between the two RTOs or how it would work. So it may not have even been an option to us to have continued that, even if the generation was available. So we reviewed other potential sites that were up in that Bakken area. A lot of those are places where we would have gas or transmission available. You know, it was chosen to look at Lewis and Clark as a primary location, largely because it's a brownfield site. We have land, natural gas that's on site sufficient, water, transmission, and also the labor forces to maintain the facilities. We also looked at a smaller project size. Instead of the 37-megawatt projects we were modeling in the IRP, to do something smaller. Alan Welty will talk a little bit about the technology we chose and why. The other one, the 19-megawatt project size, you know, was when we looked at what our minimum requirements kind of we needed fit well with our demand response programs and the other CAT generations that we had, our mobile generators, to add 19 megawatts really got us to the place we were covering our less-than-firm requirements. And the other one of having a smaller project size really made it more capable of being in service, you know, for the winter season of 2015-2016 rather than taking on a larger project and trying to get more work done. So in summary, as we look at the Lewis and Clark Rice projects, you know, they are needed to meet our customer peak demand requirements from a resource adequacy. We're transmission dependent upon Western and Basin in the Bakken area. In that, there is a need for reliability support up in the Bakken area for us to mitigate any of our customer load curtailment impacts that could occur. We also saw the threat for increases in the REC load forecast that we talked about and the in-service date for Basin's 345 kV line that really led us to the need to have something constructed and online for the winter season of 2015 and 2016.
Mr. Nigam, I have no further questions. Thank you.
Mr. Shue.
Nothing further, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco.
We have no questions.
Commissioners, Commissioner Kalk, since you've got the portfolio.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm just wondering what we paid Jack and Victor for. Don't you get, I guess you sign in for the settlement agreement you're in, right?
Huh.
All right, fine. All right, Dorsey, you ready?
Yep.
Okay. The... I don't really have any questions about the need for the rice. I mean, I think you guys made the best decision you could given the information you had. And with the change of price in oil, this is all in flux, but I think it's all going to work itself out. I just want to step back to some of the questions I was asking Tammy about. The slide that you put up there, let's see if I can find it, the modeling slide. Whatever one that one is right there, Dorsey, the 2014 to 2021. Okay, so I just want to make sure I understand. So when we go back to the Diamond Willow and Cedar Hills wind farm, those were put in well before this period, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so when we look at this PPA for 2015, is that Thunder Spirit?
It was. So the wind PPA, we had an RFP we issued. It was February of 2013 that we were looking at a number of proposals for what ended up being Thunder Spirit, in that we were still in the analysis phase, at least of the publishing of this resource plan, though we did indicate one of our preferred options for the two-year plan was a wind PPA of 50 to 100 megawatts.
Okay, so going, I can't keep track of all the different wind farms popping up and who's buying them. You have nothing in the queue now where you're looking at PPAs or your own wind farms, right?
Correct.
So the Brady wind farm and all those, you're not even meddling with those at all? Okay, so then when we jump out a little farther to 2022, that's the next time you see where you want to have wind coming into the system?
Based upon the modeling we did in 2013, correct, on a least cost basis, yes.
So your coal fleet, you're looking at those the gas stuff maybe as some of that to shore up coal retirements or other things, or how do you look at your coal fleet changes? And there's a lot going on there with our coal fleet right now. What could change this to make you put more wind into the system early?
So one of the things we looked at, and again, it was part of, you know, the analysis for the Lewis and Clark and the environmental upgrades we made,
right,
you know, was looking at that project, you know, with a shorter life. So it had a five-year life, how it was modeled. So that way, at least, you know, if there was some other requirement that came along, you know, we basically would have another opportunity to say what would the impacts of that project be. In that, from a modeling standpoint, rather than just to assume that the coal plants, you know, would run forever through the model, which is 50 years of additional life, we did model the potential retirements of two units, one that would look like Heskett 1 and one that would look like Lewis and Clark, you know, in 2020, and then to at least see what the model would start doing for replacement of those. And that's what's driving the need for that combined cycle unit, at least in 2020, is the potential retirements of those units.
Okay. And then the and this is kind of a, talking, I guess, all about these riders where I'm trying to get tie it back to. So the, you know, we put Diamond Willow and Cedar Hills into base rates. That, looking back, that was a rough rate case for a lot of different reasons. And so, you know, what are your thoughts about as we go forward that we pull Diamond Willow and Cedar Hills out of base rates and put them into the renewable rider?
I may not be the best one to answer that, but I think there has been an openness, at least from the company, to consider that. So I don't think we would be against that.
Because that was one of the things that I thought I tried to do back then, but we just couldn't make it happen. Because then I think it just is a better tracking of those resources, so you don't seem to be against that. Okay, that might clean things up a lot, quite honestly. All right, then let's switch to the transmission discussion. The when we talk about, Tammy gave us the swags for the transmission stuff, and I, like I said, I don't disagree with anything she said. So the projects that she explained that will come out of the transmission rider, I understand that. But I also want to make sure that this is my discussion with Jerry to make sure I understood it. So going forward, the ongoing cost for your transmission rider will be the MISO charges, correct?
So the MISO charges that remain in the tracker are those that correspond to Schedule 26, which are baseline reliabilities, the market efficiency projects, generator interconnects, and Schedule 26A.
And those will almost always have to be a rider because they're going to change every year up and down and who does what and depending what happens in MISO South and all those things, right?
Correct.
And that's what I'm trying to tie back to, like what of that $1.80-something is just a rough swag of what might be the ongoing MISO charges going forward. Is it going to be a buck a year? Is it going to be 50 cents a year? There's just no way of knowing. We'll have to true it up every year.
So MISO does do a publication, and it's on their website, where they forecast out what Schedule 26 and 26A costs are for every zone or every customer. So that's out on their website based upon projects that have gone through NTEP.
Okay. So then we can kind of forecast what we think that the going forward, the MISO charges will be. Now, the WAPA charges are going to go away, right? And SPP charges will come in?
Correct.
How does that play into that number that the 180 a month right now that's a transmission rider, how much of that is your WAPA charges, and what do you think SPP, and I'm not going to hold you to this, I'm just trying to get a feel for how this might play out. And what percentage do you pay WAPA for their services, and then how does that roll to SPP for their services?
So that is all will be determined through the settlement agreement.
Which you guys have inked, and we agreed to it.
And we're waiting for FERC to approve it.
Okay.
And to implement that. So once that is approved and we know if it's accepted, at least as filed, you know, it will, and we start getting the first bills, we'll start seeing what those impacts are. I think as we've talked about, we expect it to be, you know, potentially negligible. I think we've talked about a net difference from 2015 actuals to 2016, maybe when you net out a number of costs, you know, to this $250,000 number increase in total.
So the when we do the build out for these projects going forward with SPP, like I understand the MISO process better, when if you do a joint build out with SPP and their integrated planning, will ever share any of those costs? It'll always be just how much you're going to pay to use their services.
Well, I would see them in two ways. One, it's projects that they build that we pay for through the tariff rate. You know, they're projects that we're allowed to build that we get credits for against our bill.
Okay.
Or if they're interregional, then it has to go through an interregional cost sharing mechanism.
So if it's a project that you want to build, that's in their area, then MISO doesn't have a role in that?
So it would still go through both planning processes. All our facilities fall under MISO's transmission planning models. We also participate because our facilities, because we're going to get credits, are included in SPP's models that we'll review and provide solutions to them as well.
All right. So then those transmission riders will be trued up every year in December. Are you going to file that? You are somewhere about there. Okay. Now going back to the generation units here. So when the Heskett's online and the Rice units are online, I asked this to Tammy, how do you bid those into the market and have you been bidding those in? And how much are they running?
So we will bid them in like we do our other peaking plants. So we offer them into the day ahead in the real-time market at a price, which is typically priced at the cost of our fuel. And then it's up to the market to select those, you know, if they become either needed from an economic standpoint or for reliability purposes.
But you were just saying there's not enough transmission to get the electrons in to the Northwest. How do you get the electrons out of the Northwest if you're trying to – the rice units, to trying to bid those back in?
So there is a price that's set, you know, even up in that area for the load that's up – that our customer load in that area, because it's still MISO load. Okay. So it doesn't have to be exported from the area. It can just be based upon that local area. If the pricing is even high enough in that local area, because of congestion, you can't get something else up there that it would select this. Okay. Or if the market prices for the entire footprint go high enough, it would call upon this unit, assuming that you could get transmission out.
Okay. So this settlement agreement really allows you to get the cost that you need right now to keep these projects going until the rate case. As we get into the rate case, you'll work with your folks to figure out what comes out of the generation rider and what stays in. And you're open to perhaps looking at removing the Diamond Willows and Cedar Hills into the filing?
Yes.
Okay. It would be easier if you guys put it in the filing than we had to fight to take it back out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I don't know that I have any other questions, Darcy. Let me look here real quick. Oh, I know what it was. So how many touch points do you have with Otter Tail? Do you have any?
Three.
Where are they at?
So one is at Coyote Station.
Oh, of course.
For the 345 line.
Yep.
We have another one that's over at Mandan, which is on the Minn Kota's line that goes up to Center.
Okay.
And the other one is at Ellendale, the 230 line that goes to Foreman.
All right, so those are – is there any – as Otter Tail flushes through all their discussion now with SPP and FERC – does any of their interplay that back to you guys at all?
From my understanding, their issues are a little bit different than what we have in our settlement agreement, which I think is a much broader.
But your understanding is there's nothing that would swing you guys to favor Otter Tail's position better than you would SPP's position? Have you guys had a chance to look at those?
I've looked at it briefly. I have a call scheduled with them to go over some of that.
Okay.
At the end of this week, but at this point, I don't see that it changes or would swing our position.
Okay. And then the Manitoba Hydro you talked about, I forgot all about how that works again. You talked about it in there. It's available. Does that come through Basin, or how does that work?
It came through Basin because the delivery path is Tioga. You know, there is a 230 line that goes up to Boundary Dam.
Right.
And so they own that. They have rights on that. Was not open for us other than to pay for firm transmission to make some arrangement off system. And so they had made an arrangement that winter season, you know, in the lack of not having generation available, to put that in place at least kind of as an insurance policy.
So that's generally not going to be available to you going forward?
It was only available that one winter season.
Okay. Okay, thank you, sir.
Mr. Fedorchik.
Great, thank you, Darcy. This is a helpful presentation and a good look at the picture out west. I have a number of questions for you. Back to that chart, this chart, I guess, on page 5. Can you tell me what's the optimal resource case and the current MISO resource case? What's the difference between those three columns?
So the difference between columns 2 and 3 is at the time of this modeling was MISO was still new what they had done for resource adequacy when everyone had to carry their non-coincident or their requirements were all coincident to MISO's peak.
Mm-hmm.
So it would not be our peak requirements. We would carry something that's a non-coincident value. In that we were using a 90% modeling value for that. So if we had 100% customer peak demand, MISO was – we modeled we only had to carry 90 megawatts of requirements.
Mm-hmm.
What the current MISO resource adequacy was – and again, this was the first or second year that we had seen the number. We had an 80% requirement number. So if we had 100% of
is
customer
that
load –
is that what's here?
Yep. Instead of modeling 90, which we did in the optimal, we modeled 80 megawatts of requirements.
Okay. So really, what's most accurate today?
The current, the 80%, so the far right-hand side.
That's what they're modeling now? that's what MISO's requiring now.
That's why requirements have continued to be 80%. So we made that change with our 2015 IRP model that our base case now uses the 80% coincidence factor.
Okay. And where is Heskett on this chart? It's so already in?
So these would be units that either we don't own or are not committed. So Heskett 3 would have been committed. It was under construction. So we did not include it as a supply side to see if the model would continue to pick it. Even though it was being built, we justified it through the 2011 IRP and through the ADP process. It was assumed to be committed. So it doesn't show up as something new that needs to be selected or considered.
Okay. The bag house, why was that listed then?
So one of the things we wanted to know is if it was cost effective, you know, to install the additional environmental controls at Lewis and Clark. So we modeled, which is what the base case was, that Lewis and Clark was retired. And what happened, we included a new supply side option that in order for Lewis and Clark to keep running, it had to choose that initial capital investment.
So you made that a new?
Yes.
That was considered a new. And the, you talked about the 2017 ICE, 37 megawatts. Is that the RICE?
Yes, it is.
Okay. How come it's called ICE there?
At least from the
short end, confuse us.
We call it an internal combustion engine.
Okay.
Instead of reciprocating
internal. All right. The 2020 combined cycle, that's under development still. Where are we with that?
So that's was ultimately, you know, the outcome. I think one of the things we had for a takeaway in 2013 and 15 was to pursue, you know, partnerships opportunity to construct that. We're still doing that. We've not committed to anything, but we're still evaluating what our options are, you know, through talks of partnerships or self-building something. Ourselves.
And that's still kind of assuming the retirement of Lewis and Clark and Heskett?
Heskett 1.
Heskett 1, both of those?
That
or
would
one
be
or
the assumption
each?
That we're a part of that model.
Okay. And is that a done deal?
No.
What are the factors determining that? Because, boy, that's feeling really around the corner.
So part of that is, I think, the Clean Power Plan,
uh-huh.
You know, how it weighs out as far as, you know, what that is going to look like, the final rules, ultimately, once the state have their implementation plans. You know, the other ones end up being what's the best long-term position for us. You know, we know those plants particularly won't run forever. They're our oldest resources. And so one of the things in looking at this model strategy ended up saying we know they'll be retired at some point. If it's not 2020, if it's 2025, you still have to replace that. And if you plan for it instead of building a bunch of small little CTs and that's all you have for combustion turbines, you know, you can plan for that and we can do some additional analysis. We plan. At least there's a way to migrate to something that's bigger and low cost for the customers for the long term.
So that 2020 date, does that assume it comes on then or –
So in this modeling, this would have assumed that it would have been available for all of 2020.
Okay. But that's a flexible call.
It would be flexible.
It could be 2022. Or how many years out do you think you need to have the deal determined, what you're going to do, and then in order to get it online by a date certain? How many years out?
You typically, for the combined cycles, you're looking at that 4 to 5 years.
From when you've already committed to having the project?
When you start those commitments, so you start all of the permit filings and interconnection filings and the ADP filings and all the rest of those pieces. Yeah.
So that assumes all the planning is done.
So we've started some of the pre-planning already, looking at fatal flaws and kind of what would it take and, you know, at least conversations with other for partnerships that we've had. So we have some of that planning information already.
Okay. Okay, a couple other questions for you on the demand. It's been a while since we've talked about this or heard from Basin either, so my apologies for asking you a lot of these questions. But on page 8 is a chart. Let's see, I'm sorry. It's page 8 on mine. It's the top one there, the chart that says...
I have a different set of page numbers. I'm sorry.
Keep going. There, that one. Is this accurate today? This chart? Has it been updated at all by Basin or you?
It has not been updated.
Okay.
So this is the only version that I know that's available of this.
All right. What about the... So moving forward, I'm going to say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7 slides. Sorry. It's on page 11.
Commissioner Fedorchak, can I see which page it looks like, please?
Yep.
Okay.
Couple more.
Sorry.
Oh, there you go. Okay. That's it. So that shows the 2025 number at 1,400, which is, you know, back here it was 3,000 or so by 2032. It's a pretty significant decrease.
So one of the things I would say is it's looking at two different areas for loads. When we talk about the graphs and the one that was showing more specific to the Williston load pocket, it's the loads that are contained within this shaded area here.
And so that's when you're talking about this chart versus this?
Correct. So what the other chart that came out of the report is they were looking at the loads that were in all of these counties.
Bakken load growth.
Correct.
And this isn't Bakken load?
So this is the Bakken load growth that Cattermusley and Jackson looked at, was the growth in the three states, and it was in those counties. Mm-hmm. And they came up with a county-by-county growth rate for those. In that, these other graphs are the load that are just in the smaller subset of area. And that's driven by the transmission constraints.
Okay, so, but I'm looking at this chart. What's the difference for that one then?
So that chart pertains to just the loads that are in this pocket here. That would be the Williston load pocket.
I see. Williston load pocket. All right, got it. I guess what I'm getting back to is at one point you said that you're looking at your demand to grow by, what did I write down? To double in 2 to 3 years. Is that what you're still expecting?
So that was what we foresaw in 2012.
Right.
So when we started to see the growth, the one thing that we saw is at least the loads from our communities, particularly the large ones, the Williston's, Tioga's, Watford City's, Ray's, that they would end up doubling in size, their loads, which they have.
So they have, and what are you expecting moving forward?
So in 2012, we had... I don't have the prepared numbers. In 2012, our load that was in that pocket, we talked about the Williston load pocket, was around, for a winter peak, was around 80 to 90 megawatts is where we were sitting, or at least that would be what our firm requirements were. I think where we've grown to in that pocket, we're up to about 140 to 150 megawatts.
Okay. And moving forward, what are you projecting?
So we're still projecting, at least the last forecast we did, that we would be adding somewhere between maybe 10 megawatts a year in that pocket,
okay.
5 to 10.
All right. Okay. So then on the most disturbing charts, the blue ones that show the Bakken load forecast and impacts of 2014, really the NESET, the AVS, the NESET project, if it's on time versus if it's a year delayed. Where are we with that? I might have missed you. Are we looking at the 1 year delayed?
So that project did go into service around Christmas time.
Most of it, right? Not the whole.
The portion that went from AVS up to Williston went in service.
Yep.
Where NESET is the continuation to Tioga.
Yep. So which of these charts then is...
So
what we're looking at.
So right now we're sitting in this situation here. It's probably the best chart to look at because this was assuming the delay of that AVS to, you know, Williston NESET by a year, which would not have come online until next, you know, this coming winter season next year.
So that is the situation we're in, or we're not?
We're in this situation right here. This is the one where the 345 line came in service the end of 15.
Okay. All right. So we've kind of avoided that potential
we have
significant issue.
But the issue is still out there. If this line would trip out of service,
I see.
Then we're back down to where this line is. That's one of the things. Even though we may say system intact, you mm-hmm. know, it looks like there's sufficient transmission. That only is if it's all in service.
Yep. And so that's the Rice is an answer to that. One of the answers to help. If that were to happen, you've got this backup.
Correct. Because the alternatives, if you can't serve all the load, is you have to run local generation demand response. You know, in that, it allows us more resources, which are the Rice units, to be able to respond to curtailments,
mm-hmm.
you know, reliability issues up in the pocket.
Can you talk about what sort of demand response programs you analyzed as an alternative or a supplement to addressing some of these, and how many megawatts could you save with demand response, an aggressive demand response program?
So our demand response, there are currently two of them, largely for the larger customers. There's the traditional Rate 38 customers we have, and then our C-Power, Commercial Demand Response Program. In that, we had targeted, when we put our C-Power demand response and program in place, that we could potentially grow that up to 25 megawatts total. That's across our entire footprint.
How does it work, the C-Power? What's the trigger? How?
So the commercial, our Rate 38 customers, we contract with directly, and we market and we call upon them to interrupt their load.
Okay.
So typically it's like the Capitol, this building. Also, the other ones that we do have are some of our other large customers that either have standby generation or they just agree to shut their process down, mm-hmm. American Colloid, and just go home. We have
standby. You've got 25 megawatts of that?
We had planned it to be potentially up to that. And that's all driven by getting out and marketing with large customers, saying here's how it works, here's what you can save, and trying to get customers to sign up. We had tried to target specifically the larger customers up there, those that were probably 100 kilowatts, 500 kilowatts and higher for peak demand, and particularly those that had standby generation. And so some of the customers we've put under that up there is Williston State College is one. There is a hotel up there that's under that has standby generation. And Air Liquide, also at Tioga, is under that program. They just agreed to shut their process down. Separate from that,
how many megawatts is that then?
I think that's about 4.
Okay. So you thought there was 25 potential, but you only realized 4 today.
So the 25 would be across our entire footprint. So,
okay.
So when we entered into that agreement was prior to this growth in the Bakken. We had looked to implement that across our entire footprint.
Mm-hmm.
When we took a look at the subset of the Bakken up there, I think we estimated maybe we could get to 10 to maybe, around 10 megawatts as far as a number inside of that of the 25.
And is that something that's still a target, or how is the company approaching that as another solution up there?
We're still trying to market that and to get it out to customers, at least as a way for, for cost savings, and certainly it helps us, reliability and for resource adequacy purposes.
Mm-hmm.
Separate from that, we've had expansions of our Rate 38 programs or similar Rate 38 that we did enter into an agreement with the Williston Water Treatment Plant where they put in 4 megawatts of standby generation, and we designed that with them so it could operate in parallel with our system, and we have an ability to actually remotely start those and stop those if we need to.
Mm-hmm.
And they're looking at installing another 2 megawatts this spring at the wastewater facility at Williston as well. So that would get us 6 in Williston, and the city of Watford City has been interested in some of that as well, but we haven't contracted for anything. So
you actually control it. If you need it, you turn it on.
Yes.
Do they even know?
We give them a phone call to tell them we're running it.
Mm-hmm.
But, they wanted us from a response standpoint rather than them to have to follow through with the 30-minute start requirements, just said, give us a call and you take care of that.
And what is it? What is it that they turn on?
So they're smaller reciprocating engines is what they have, 2 megawatt machines.
So they've got 4 and you're looking at 2 more?
At a different site up there in Williston.
Mm-hmm. The other program you talked about, you called it C-Power?
Correct. That's the company we've contracted with.
Okay. Is what needs to be done to make it more appealing so more customers want to do that? or in either case, I guess, is there a way to make these more appealing so you can get more customers signed on in these programs?
I think we've looked at some of that. You know, when we started to roll these out, everything was so busy and hectic with the pace up there. Most companies were just looking at, you know, getting things moving, getting the day-to-day work done, that they, you know, weren't willing to focus back on some of these costs, you know, cutting measures that they could participate with. Mm-hmm. So we've been trying to circle back with them and continue to find ways to market this program and find ways to expand it. So, you know, certainly the consideration is, you know, time that customers have, you know, truly showing them that they have a need, that they have time mm-hmm. to realize that, and then making sure, you know, if it's anything, it's the incentives, you know, that we pay are high enough for them to participate. Mm-hmm.
And then on this also demand response, I think I remember seeing in your integrated resource plan an AC cycling program that you plan to develop. Is that true?
So we were looking at the air conditioned cycling program, you know, more on the residential side.
Mm-hmm.
And that's still a program that we're evaluating and have not, you know, committed to roll that out yet, but we're still looking at that.
And what are the factors? Help me understand that program and it seems like a no-brainer to me. But I must be missing something. There must be some downsides to that or something that's prohibitive to starting that type of a program.
So it comes as a cost. You know, there are fixed costs, one, to put a programmable meter in every, you know, customer's, you know, home that participate, and the other one is what's the incentive level that you pay them. You know, at one point we looked at it was it's sufficient, you know, incentive enough just to put a meter in a customer's home so they could, you know, could do the programming and could see that stuff. But yet they also would be subjective at least to having, you know, interruptions in their air conditioned cooling. And so the question ends up being, is that sufficient enough for a customer to say, yeah, I'll take a new meter or, you know, the thermostat that I would have, or what's the annual incentive that it ends up taking? And then the other one for us, it's the program cost to continue to have the communication systems. You know, and then how do you turn around, one, market that stuff, and two, make sure that you're getting the benefits that you expect and can use it.
And can you make it attractive enough in terms of a lower rate to get people to sign up and actually then make the savings work out for you?
And I think that's one of the things we're still looking at. You know, one, what are those program costs to get, you know, sufficient momentum by the customers? And then ultimately, what are the recovery mechanisms for the fixed cost that it takes for the ongoing costs?
And have you looked at any estimates for how much you might be able to save in peak demand with a program like that?
I think some of the back of the envelope numbers I've seen, you know, are some of those, you know, if you got sufficient participation, you're talking somewhere, you know, in that 2 to maybe 10 megawatts, you know, mm-hmm. sort of response that you would end up having. But again, that's across our entire footprint.
Okay, thank you, Darcy.
Mr. Chrisman.
I just want to continue on that same concept, and I don't want to imply that I'm necessarily encouraging this, but it was a point of discussion at the Energy Generation Conference last week, is energy efficiency programs. What does MDU do to try and frighten or coerce people into doing things they otherwise might not do to, you know, do more energy efficiency things, whether it's replacing refrigerators or different bulbs or whatever?
So we've had particularly, I think Montana is the better example of what we end up doing, largely because we have funding for programs out there through the USB funding that's available to us. We can fund some of those programs.
USB fundings.
It's the Universal Service Benefit funding that we have there are some of those programs, you know, for either it's for low-income programs or we do for our, you know, conservation programs. But a lot of those, they take some sort of investment, you know, to fund those rebates that it takes for customers to swap out refrigerators or put in different lighting. You know, we do have lighting programs, you know, I believe in North Dakota. Nope, no lighting programs in North Dakota. Montana has that at least for the energy-efficient lighting. You know, there are some of those rebates, at least on the commercial side, that go back to customers. And a lot of that is because the state of Montana has, you know, encouraged the funding of those sorts of programs, you know, through, you know, recovery mechanisms. You know, those don't exist in North Dakota. So in the absence of funding, it's really up to the customer then is what it's been left to decide if they want to have the energy savings or not. You know, we provide information in our website, and I think Bill Stuffers as well, just around energy efficiency and what they could do to save money. But, you know, there are no set programs that are at least funded.
But that's something that the utility regulators out there have allowed you to build into your rates, the resources necessary to provide that program.
Correct.
Okay. Well, refresh me on Heskett 3. When did that become operational?
August of 2014.
And is the production from that about, how does the production compare in the last year and a half to what was expected when it was, when you first planned the plant?
It would be below what was forecasted. So it has run very similar to our other peaking plants, you know, which is maybe, you know, 10 starts a year.
I expected it was below, but, like, is it half as much or just a little less or only runs 10% as much as you would have thought? Or
only about 10% as much as we expected.
Okay. And, would you go to the slide that's on my page 13? So it's a couple beyond where I think where you left off here. Well, maybe one more slide forward.
Commissioner Christman, what does it look like, please?
That's it.
This is it, okay.
So this is sort of a long question. It's more of a theory thing, okay? So when I look on there and I see not enough time to construct, a lot, I mean, I see the financial issues too, but not enough time to construct, project timing issues, lack of access to some sites. And I find myself wondering if, as we do things like Heskett 3, like with the Lewis and Clark generators, making more deals with someone else to carry the transmission, as opposed to doing something large, are we as regulators, and I don't mean just specifically North Dakota, but the regulatory environment that you guys are under, are we putting companies under such scrutiny that you just can't hardly do what used to occur in the 60s and 70s where someone built something big that I presume had more capacity than what they could justify on the immediate ribbon-cutting date? Is that just a thing of the past because we'd be immediately beating you up for building beyond what was needed? Or why does that thing, kind of thing, never occur and we continue to tinker around? I didn't mean that in a bad way. We continue to do these smaller projects that meet the specific demand for the specific date, just barely. And I presume that every one of these now makes it harder to justify something larger.
So one of those, I would say there are some of those larger projects, you know, we've tried to pursue in the past. You know, one would be the Big Stone 2 project. You know, certainly that would have been, you know, large. It was something big. Ultimately, in the absence of being able to do something regionally, which if something is bigger for us, it requires partners, you know, and certainly a lot more time. In the absence of being able to do that, you know, we had to come back with how do you fill the, you know, that immediate need, because we certainly had a capacity need. You know, we tried to go out for requests for proposals. We got some of those to at least to be able to bridge some amount of time and the uncertainty of Big Stone 2. You know, ultimately what was available to us, you know, at the time of Heskett 3 through RFPs and, you know, some of the pieces led to Heskett 3. So it wasn't a primary option. It ended up being kind of the secondary piece as far as you know, of what occurred at least from the Big Stone 2 unwinding. The other one I would say in our resource planning is if we continue to look at, you know, just doing just-in-time facilities, we've always said it's just going to keep adding one of these LM6000s, 40-megawatt blocks at a time, and that's all we get to. It's one of the reasons in our resource planning in 2013 to try to plan for something bigger, what would it take to get to something bigger? You know, we looked at those potential unit retirements, and we've talked with partners about larger combined cycle projects. And so I think we've moved on some of those. We just have had needs, if it ends up being for, you know, Heskett 3 that was really filled in the absence of Big Stone 2. If Big Stone 2 would have been built, we wouldn't have needed Heskett 3. You know, we talk about a need in the Bakken. We tried to run through not having to build something, thinking there was enough capacity up there, that all of a sudden, because of others' forecasts, it changed for us. We had to meet a particular need, and we also had a resource adequacy need for our customers long term to pursue that. We tried to keep it small so we could still keep working on a larger facility, which is still what we're targeting, you know, in our resource plan, is finding some way to get to a larger project, more efficient long-term benefits, if we can get partnerships or if we can, you know, sufficiently show what, you know, the need is out there.
Okay, and I think my last question, the combined cycle plant that was on the schedule for 2020, I presume that would be something after that, because that's the beginning of 2020, is only less than 4 years away now. As you work on that potential partnership to put that together and try and put together a plan that makes economic sense for MDU as well as whoever your partners would be, has making that project make economic sense become harder now that we have these reciprocating engines at Lewis and Clark?
I don't think the reciprocating engines will make it harder. They're certainly small enough when we tried to size it to what the need was. And so instead of, you know, putting in something larger there and impacting the schedule, the only thing that the reciprocating engines will likely do from a need basis is just push the need for that combined cycle maybe out a year, is what it would end up doing. But again, that's largely driven by the timing, at least, of potentially other unit retirements or whatever the timing ends up being for, you know, Clean Power Plan compliance.
Okay. No other questions. Thank you, Darcy.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a couple of follow-up, Darcy, with what Randy was talking about. I guess you reminded us about the work that you guys did with Big Stone 2. You guys tried really hard at that, and you were like the last of the Mohegans, and you were. I mean, everybody else jumped ship on you guys, and so that was a lot of effort by you guys to build base load that didn't come through, but not because you guys didn't try till the very end. So I think that's a good point to bring. I always bring that back up. And then the point about how we're building generation now and transmission, didn't really Order 1000 set the stage for the box we're in right now? You've got RTOs out there, and that was the envision of what they wanted to do with the future of energy generation?
It's another consideration. Certainly regional-wise goes through that, you know, additional processes and potentially competitive bid processes.
Because I'm with Commissioner Crispin all the way on what we used to do and how we would like to do it, but it seems like the stage has been set long before we got here, that the future of energy is going to be these regional projects and it's going to get more challenging.
The other part of that is cost allocation. So certainly if it can be regionally justified and you can share it with others, that's the push everyone has. If you decide to go something alone, you know, you run the risk that it's on your back. Yep.
And my last point is just a comment, but maybe ask your input. If you install a program where you incentivize people to replace the refrigerators, isn't it true that their new fridges go in their house and their old fridges go in the garage?
That's what typically happens.
Just to make a note why we do not incentivize that in North Dakota, because of experience in Botno, Paul and I have about that. You buy a new fridge, where's the old one go? That's all I have.
It's true.
Mr. Sanderson.
I have no further questions. Thank you.
Mr. Hsu.
Nothing, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle.
I do have one or two. Number one would be, why did the IRP model choose ICE rather than combustion turbine for those units?
So they're chosen, one, they're more efficient. So our model sees a need for both capacity and energy. So as they were modeled, the capacity cost was a little cheaper with the combustion turbines, but the energy efficiency, or at least the energy conversion factor, efficiency factor for the RICE units was more efficient. So it's a combination of the two.
Okay. And another question about your IRP. And your IRP still incorporates analysis of energy efficiency options in the mix, does it not?
Yes, it does.
And do they result in recommended energy efficient energy efficiency programs?
Yes, they do.
Okay. Thank you.
Commissioners, anything else?
I don't.
Okay. Mr. Sanderson.
All right, we call our next witness, Alan Welty.
While Mr. Welty's walking up there, it's getting to look like we might run into the noon hour. Do you think we'll be able to finish?
I personally believe Mr. Welty will be the shortest of our witnesses and shouldn't take too long.
I guess I'm going to ask the commissioners, if we don't get done with Mr. Welty till 11:45, and we've got Mr. Shook after, I believe. Do you want a break for lunch, or do you want to go straight through?
I guess I would like to see how long it takes with Mr. Welty, and then we might be able to, you know, if he takes 15, 20 minutes, then we might be able to. How long do you expect your witness to take, Jack?
I anticipate my witness to be brief, Your Honor, Commissioner.
Okay.
Okay.
So, well, I mean, my preference would be to go through, maybe just stand up.
Okay.
All right. Stand up, sit down, get going again. But I don't know how you guys feel.
I just want to see if that's...
Keep rolling.
If everybody, okay. All right. Mr. Welty, you were here when I gave the perjury admonition?
Yes.
Raise your right hand, please. You promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
I do.
Okay.
Good morning, Mr. Welty. Could you please state your full name and business address for the record?
Yes, my name is Alan L. Welty. Business address is 400 North 4th Street, Bismarck.
And whom are you employed by?
I'm employed as a director of generation for Montana Dakota Utilities Company.
And could you briefly describe your responsibilities with MDU?
Yes, my responsibilities include overall responsibility for our operating electric generation fleet. I represent the company's interests on joint-owned units that are operated by others, and I also have generation development responsibilities.
And could you briefly provide us with your educational background and work experience?
Yes, I have a Bachelor's of Science degree in Mechanical Engineering from North Dakota State University. My overall business experience with Montana Dakota include 8 years of power plant engineering experience, 12 years of power plant manager experience, and about 11 years in my current role as director of generation.
And Mr. Welty, you're familiar with MDU's application in this proceeding?
Yes.
Okay. And I understand you've prepared PowerPoint slides regarding your testimony here?
I have.
And what are the subjects that you'll be addressing today with your testimony?
In my testimony, I will give an update on the Lewis and Clark Rice Unit technology construction schedule and cost.
Okay. And using your PowerPoints, could you just walk the commission through your testimony here today?
Yes. Beginning with just a short review of things we've discussed in the past, this, most of this was presented in a PI meeting in February of 14. the Lewis and Clark Rice project includes two Wärtsilä model 20V34SG gas engine generator sets. So each one of them is 9.3 megawatts for a total of 18.6. At the time we gave this presentation, we had estimated the cost without loadings at about $40 million. These are very low emission units. They include they're fired on natural gas. They have a spark-ignited lean combustion system. They're equipped with the best available emissions control technologies. So for NOx control, they have SCRs, selective catalytic reduction, and for CO, they have catalytic oxidation. They are very high efficiency, as Darcy had mentioned in the discussion about how they compete with other units in the resource planning. They require minimal water consumption. They have a very good operating profile. they're quite often selected because they do very well performance-wise at higher elevations, and they they don't see D rates at higher ambient conditions, so temperature conditions. So we talked about the efficiency profile is fairly flat. It's almost almost level down to about 80%, and it's in going down from there. They require very low gas pressure requirements compared to combustion turbines. So 75 to 125 PSI versus, say, 300, or some of them are up over 600 PSI, which requires additional gas compression equipment. So that's good. And then as peakers, they their maintenance is not affected by the number of starts. So you can start and stop these, many times a day, and you don't take the maintenance hit you would on a combustion turbine where you have all the more exotic metals that are going through thermal cycles. These are just a reciprocating engine and just like starting your car and shutting it off many times a day. So those are some of the key key points there. Just to review kind of the layout of this project, this is a 3D model cut. Looking from the right to going towards the left, so on the far right, there's the generator interconnection and generator step-up transformer. In the middle is the what we call the service building. And then leaving the service building, the exhaust system, you can see the two orange pieces. Those are the SCR and CADOX vessels. And then the flue gas goes to the two individual stacks. The in the far left is the radiators that are used for process cooling of the, basically mostly for the oil, the, cooling the oil. And then in the background behind the stacks is a small tank farm that includes the urea tank for the SCR reagent and then lube oil. So these things do require a number of tanks for waste or used and new oil. Just opening the roof, if you will. The service building has several pieces to it, including a small battery room, electrical switchgear room, and then a maintenance shop, which also encloses the starting and instrument air compressors. And then you can see the area that's called the engine hall. A couple of items in addition to what you see in these drawings that we that were included in the project were on the electric interconnection side, we added a 115 kV bay to our existing substation. And on the gas side, we installed a short pipeline on site to connect to the existing pipeline. And there was some additional meters and regulation that needed to be done at the point of interconnection on the WBI system. I want to talk a little bit about the schedule. as Darcy described our critical need to mitigate those possibilities for the winter of 15-16. The project had to be on a fast-track schedule. We continued to pursue partnerships opportunities to build something with somebody else at the same time that we were having to develop this project. Construction had to begin before the detailed design was substantially completed, and then the general work contractor that we selected had to expedite a number of their subcontracts just to stay on the schedule. Here's a list of some of the key dates just to give you an idea of how fast this was. From the time we began air permitting work, even before we had selected engine technology, from that time we did the preliminary air permitting work till when the unit was declared as available for commercial operations was 19 months. If you break that down a little bit further, from the time that we issued a contract with Ward Solar, which is the equipment supplier, that was only 14 months. And So it was very tight. Talking a little bit about the costs. So the two of the major contracts we had on this project were one for the equipment supply with Wärtsilä, and the other one was with Korval Group for the construction of the equipment. The Wärtsilä contract was they were selected from an evaluation of five other OEMs that provided this size of equipment, and Korval was selected from a group of five other contractors bidding. So let me turn to the next one. So this project is significantly higher on a cost per kW basis, primarily due to the smaller size and due to the timing of the project. Choosing the smaller units, as Darcy had alluded or mentioned before, it avoided additional transmission upgrades to get the interconnection done, and it was the best fit for the need we had at that moment. The lower total cost for buying the units was offset significantly by the higher balance of plant construction and engineering costs. I think that would be where we saw the major increase over what we would have anticipated, or if we could have built this project under a slower schedule away from the Bakken and made it a little bit larger. And finally, as we've mentioned already today, having failure of meeting that need in that area as not an option, when we look at this project, the costs still remain competitive with investments necessary that we would have to do on a transmission basis. And as Darcy mentioned, we didn't really have the option from a timing perspective to even do that. So I have a couple of pictures to show that it actually exists, and it's so this is a picture from inside the engine hall of the looking at one of the engine generator sets of the two. And here's a site view of the project, and you can showing Lewis and Clark 1 in the background. So
Mr. Welty, I have no further questions. Thank you.
Mr. Shu? Mr. Welty, you stated that building in the Bakken had an impact on the cost. I was wondering if you could describe to us the extent building in the Bakken had an effect on the cost of this project.
It would be difficult to speculate the exact impact because we did not bid this project somewhere else, of course. Back of the envelope from the information I've seen, I would say that impact was in the 15% to 20% of the construction cost.
And you used the two Wärtsilä rice units, and there were no smaller units, even non-rice, that would have been that were lower cost that could have been used at this location.
As I mentioned, we evaluated rice technologies in a certain megawatt range, and Wärtsilä units were the lowest cost.
Okay. No other questions, Your Honor. Thank you.
Mr. Jeff Kotsako, questions?
Was there consideration given to building CT instead of this?
There was consideration given to a CT as it worked its way through the integrated resource planning. I could add further to that. I'm not believing that we could have permitted a CT in the time we needed to get it installed and up.
That was going to be one of my questions. I didn't know what all factors. Darcy mentioned a couple quickly or one, and I didn't know what other factors went into that consideration.
Absolutely. The just on a general basis, if you compared about the equivalent amount of these rice projects to a combustion turbine, say a LM6000, which is about 45 megawatts, the rice unit is competitive on an efficiency perspective, but some of the tenuous things that would be involved in fast-tracking and getting it something like that installed in this area would be around the permitting. So, as I mentioned, the rice unit has a very straightforward operating efficiency and emissions profile versus a combustion turbine. There's issues with it's very lumpy going through the load range with the rice units. Building two of them versus one combustion turbine, you can turn them down within an engine and then shut one off, so you have a less lumpy emissions profile and turn down. So those are a number of the things that come to mind.
Thank you.
Commissioners, Commissioner Kalk.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Alan, for your testimony. One thing I'll say up front is I commend MDU that you guys made decisions and you built something. I mean, if it would have been 30 below this last week instead of 30 above, you'd have been running these suckers all the time. So it's pretty easy to Monday morning quarterback here saying, well, this, that. I mean, that's me personally. I think I'm glad you built this stuff. And we'll roll it. We'll get it all figured out. But that's where, sure, maybe could we have saved $2 if knowing exactly what it would? Who knows? But you made the right call, I think, from my viewpoint, is to get it built, get it online, and have it available. Because like we talked about, there's no other availability there. I mean, I think that your case is pretty good on that. I do just have a couple just my knowledge questions in some of this. When I should have maybe dug a little deeper with Dorothy, but I know that when you bid this into the market, it clears whatever price people are willing to pay. But what's the rule of thumb cost per kilowatt? I mean, I can figure coal, I know about 6-8 cents, maybe high wind, I'll throw 12-15. I mean, how do you figure something like this, the cost per kilowatt to run, just as a general range?
At current gas prices, I don't have that number in my mind, but it would be competitive with our other LM6000.
So be competitive with other gas units?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not better or worse based on its efficiency?
It would actually be better.
Because you don't have to worry about numerous startups?
Yeah.
Okay. And then you talked about very low emissions. What does that mean, very low emissions? Is that lower than traditional, the gas units you just talked about, or is that just the word you happen to put up there?
Of course, this unit, when compared to like Heskett 3, has a SCR and a CADOX on it.
Okay.
But Heskett 3 was equipped with what we call dry low NOx emissions. So in one case, you're using the combustion technology to try to minimize your NOx. With the rice, you're doing that as well as installing what we call best emissions controls on there. The one thing I should say about that is we really didn't feel we had an option to not install the SCR and the CADOX on and still get it permitted to meet that same time.
You saw my next question coming up, right? How are you able to do that? And then as the Clean Power Plan unfolds, will this be a new source review kind of thing, or will this be fine no matter how this plays out?
These will be fine. That was the other thing that I did not mention. Because of their size, they kind of fell under the new source part of the Clean Power Plan in terms of the hoops we had to jump through to get them permitted.
Perfect. And then last two questions. When you talk about working with other parties, I mean, traditionally you think of Otter Tail and Basin and those. But can you, let's say if you got a company out of Kansas that wants to build generation, can you build joint generation with a company out of state and then they kick in their money and then they're willing to, as you bid this into a market, they're able to make this work, or is this partners are only limited to people that are physically in the area?
I'll take a stab at that. It would be very difficult if they weren't able to participate within the same market, and then of course there are those infrastructure issues.
So another MISO generator could participate with you, do you believe? Dorsey says yes. Okay. Fair enough. And then the last question is just more of nothing to do with this case, but the recently the commission approved the Dakota Access Pipeline, which it was interesting. I probably had 30 phone calls about people asking me, hey, I'd like to bid in this job. How do I do it? They're calling me to bid. And I just refer back that it's not, we don't do that. But if we get to similar calls from you, where do the, if someone wants to bid in MDU's jobs, where do they go?
Mostly on these large generation type projects, we would use a consulting engineer and we would assemble a list of what we would call people that we think are capable of doing these types of projects of the size and.
But if somebody just wants to bid and work with you, they have.
Certainly they would call me in the interim or our group, and then okay. we would
call MDU and talk for Alan, okay.
Yeah, thanks.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Fedorchak.
Yeah. Thank you, Alan. How have you? Can you put an estimate on how much more this project cost because it needed to be fast-tracked? I'm assuming that some of those timelines didn't come cheap.
Right. Again, as I mentioned, we did not bid the project in a different location in a shorter time frame.
Mm-hmm.
Just from information I've accumulated over time, I would say that it would be more likely that we could have built this unit somewhere else in a slower time frame at, say, in the $1,700 to $1,900 per kW versus what it came in at about $2,300.
Came in at $2,300.
Your Honor, I didn't hear his answer. It was too soft.
Okay. Can you repeat that, Alan?
Sure. I would, as just a rough estimate, I would say that if we were able to build this unit outside of the Bakken not in such a tight time frame, and maybe at a slightly larger size, it might have been more in the $1,700 to $1,900 per kW.
And then this one was how much per kW?
Around $2,300.
So and about a $400 to $600 difference, you're speculating.
And I may have missed this with the conversation with Commissioner Christman, but if you had gotten the big stone, would this have been needed? Was there any correlation there?
This project would have likely still been needed because of the urgent need that Darcy described.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then also, I've heard some talk about how often this is going to run or how often other things are running. How often do you think that you'll be using this facility?
I believe... If we compare it to Heskett 3, I believe this unit will probably run more frequently, mainly because of its reliability types of situations that we get into in that area.
Because of its location?
Yeah.
Okay. So what are you estimating as a king of generation?
Yeah, that's a hard one. I would say it will run, a few percentage of time to start with, of the year.
Okay, and at what times of year? What time do you likely see? Is it summer or winter?
Well, certainly during peak periods, but also with the way the transmission is hooked together out there, just getting a transmission line out for service can dictate when this unit will be running. Darcy's nodding his head on that one, too. So those are the main factors.
Okay.
It's getting more and more difficult for in that area region to take a large transmission out for maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
And these units will be critical to that.
And then, again, I'm going to ask you some questions about demand response, mostly for my own education. I just want to learn more about this this whole area of generation from a technical standpoint. Could you trigger a demand response program to fit the same need as this? Like, say you have to have a peaker. Could you say, no, we're going to pull X number of people off? And would it have the same technical impact?
If I understand the question, I think that's exactly what we're doing. Like, as Darcy mentioned, at the water treatment plant, for instance, they've made a commitment with us so that we could run that unit parallel with the system on call, so to speak. So that'd be similar to how this unit will be operated. There'll be a call from MISO from a cost perspective or a reliability call. We'll get that message to the plant, and they'll start it up and run.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you could do a similar thing on a peaking perspective.
And would it have to be right in that area? Is that a would it have to be right in that Bakken region, or could it be system-wide?
Absolutely, to mitigate the problems with a loss of transmission, as Darcy had mentioned.
So to equal the potential of this unit, you'd need 18.6 megawatts of demand response in that region. But otherwise, if you had that, it would be the same. Essentially the same effect on reliability and everything else.
I couldn't speak specifically to every reliability concern, but from a demand response perspective, providing load into the same region, it should be to provide the same benefits.
Okay. All right. I think that's all my questions. Thank you.
Mr. Chrisman.
What's the employee need for this? Is this for the Lewis and Clark edition? Is that so simple that the employees that work at the regular coal-fired Lewis and Clark station run this too? Or is there a separate employee team?
That's a great question. The one of the reasons we co-located it there was because we could use the existing staff to operate and maintain it. And going further into your question, it is very simple. I've told my engineering team and support team that have been working on this project, it'll probably be more difficult to learn how to run the HVAC system than the engines themselves. So they're very simple. Commissioning for these went very quickly as compared to a combustion turbine, where you have this lumpy emissions profile and all those things you have to tune to be at their optimal. So
it required no additional hiring.
Lewis and Clark was kind of a lightning rod with a number of projects over the last year or two. So between the mercury and air toxics rule, which we did, if you remember, we did a scrubber modification. Mm-hmm. And this project, we're adding one mechanic. Okay. And then the level of operators maybe has changed by one. However, it's been very difficult to stay at full staff there, so very little impact. And then those will be allocated over all of that.
Okay. And then does it burn like regular dry gas that your customers in town would be using, or is this set up to burn the natural wet mix of gas, whatever the right terminology is for that?
It has to have what we call pipeline quality gas. So to the extent that the gas in that area has high methane or whatever, it still has to meet some tariff. So it's able to burn pushing the envelope as far as the pipeline quality, but it's not set up to do anything additional.
Okay, and lastly, is Wärtsilä the model number, or is that the company makes it?
That's a company from Finland.
Finland?
Yes.
Okay.
They have probably the biggest market share of these type of generating facilities in the United States.
Mm-hmm. No other questions. Thank you.
Mr. Sanderson.
Nothing further, Your Honor.
Mr. Hsu.
Nothing, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco.
Nothing, thank you.
Commissioners, anything?
I always have to one more, Judge.
Commissioner Kalk.
Alan, just to clarify, would you agree with the statement that the runtime will correlate to the temperature extremes. Gets really hot or gets really cold, you're going to need this power.
Yeah, it'll certainly, that would certainly be the, one of the primary drivers.
Like Tammy's answer, always say temperature, right? But I mean, I think that's, I think that's,
on the weather.
I think that's true, right? I mean, when you're going to have your peaks coming, it's going to be because of temperature extremes.
To the extent of when our load peaks are, it'll be running, if it runs, and then of course these other
outages, right?
Yeah, the other thing is the transmission outages and
gotcha.
Reliability.
And then the Commissioner Fedorchuk, I think, was on a very good discussion point about demand response, but I did want to kind of qualify a little bit. Demand response doesn't always correlate one-to-one. It has to do with the frequency of how long you need that demand response for, right?
If that's, it's that's a good point. Some of those the equipment that's been put in service there is certainly not as rugged as, like, for instance, these rice units. They're meant to run for shorter periods of time or less frequently. These are more rugged.
But when you do your demand response contracts with whoever you're working with, don't they usually put some parameters on there, like we'll move you from the system for 2 hours max or something? It's not like you can just remove them for 10 hours at a shot.
Right.
So there's constraints that that works.
I'm not completely familiar with what those are.
And then last thought is that as you look forward to Lewis and Clark, can you convert that whole thing to a gas burner instead of coal?
Lewis and Clark is kind of unique in that...
Because now you're splitting a little bit, right? Doesn't it have some gas being injected up there now?
Well, we use gas at this time for startups, and we can supplement the coal burn with gas. However, the unit is unique in that we can burn 100% gas there right now.
Okay, so when you talk about, and this is maybe back to Dorsey, the future of this plant, it may exist as a gas plant completely, not as a coal plant.
To the extent it would make sense and be competitive with other alternatives at that time, right?
So that was one of the options I didn't see, and the thing was convert Lewis and Clark to completely a gas unit. Or did I just miss that, maybe?
I think in our subset of our analysis around the baghouse for the mats, I think we did some gas
modeling. Okay.
Gas scenarios.
Separate discussion.
The one thing that has become that's new to that question is that with the infrastructure that's changed in the gas transmission in that area, we now feel that we will be able to get firm capacity or firm light capacity for not only the rice units but possibly the coal plant running on gas.
Right, because isn't One Oak like literally down the street?
Yeah, they're not too far away.
Right? Okay, thank you.
Anything else?
Me.
Okay, Mr. Welty, you're free to step down. Mr. Sanderson, do you want to call Mr. Nigam back just for confirm a few of those head nods on the record?
We can, Your Honor.
I think that might be a good idea.
We called Darcy Nigam.
Thank you.
The microphone didn't pick up the head nods.
Just a reminder, you're still under oath, Mr. Nigam. Okay, Mr. Sanderson.
Darcy, a couple points during Mr. Welty's testimony. Some questions were asked of him that he kind of referred to you and kind of indicated you may be the person who has more expertise in that area. Could you just shed some light on a couple of those instances?
If I can remember the question, so some of those deal with, like the offers that we do have, the generation that we do have in MISO. The resources themselves aren't so much a levelized cost of the resource we offer it in it. It ends up being, since the cost of the fuel, your marginal cost. So today it's about a 3 cent number for the rice. Mm-hmm. I think the other one on some of the demand response that we have are certainly even the C-Power customers have an hour limit. And so they're limited to like 50 hours a year of participation. So they fill a need as far as demand response goes, but they're not available, for continued long-term support that this unit would end up being.
I have a question then.
Okay.
I would have no other questions.
Okay. Let me just run through the attorneys first and then Mr. Hsu.
No, Your Honor.
This is Jeff Kotsako.
Nothing, thank you.
Okay, commissioners.
And then just to clarify, Dorsey, I had to ask the question about the partners in the region that aren't adjacent. How does that work?
you could have anyone from a partner, you know, if they were financial, because we could end up being the market participant that would market the all of the energy into the market. You don't have to separately dispatch with a partner.
But could a Kansas generator in SPP or MISO become a partner in a project with you?
It would be a MISO generator, so they would be. It wouldn't serve their load, their need in SPP. They would just do it as a financial position.
But they can do it. Okay. That was the only question. Thank you.
Commissioner Fedorchak.
So is the one-hour limit a technical issue? You place it on them because it only is valuable to you for 1 hour for some technical reasons, or is it on their end to help me understand that, Darcy?
It's on both. So typically what we limit it to for Constellation says it's a total of 50 hours per year, and it ends up being 4 hours max. So one, it impacts their business. So how long are they willing to have their business impacted? And certainly they don't want to be interrupted for 500 to 1,000 hours. They won't participate. So it's really meant to be that very much peaking, mm-hmm. you know, sorts of requirements that are out there.
And is that a negotiated time frame? Each one is different, or how do you arrive at those figures, those hours?
So we had a standard offer. So mm-hmm. as we worked with C-Power to put together a program they would market. It was agreed upon hours that we would look for participation. And there also is, if there is an interruption, there's a loss of business opportunity, the payment that goes to them as well. And that could also cover fuel costs if they're running a generator.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's it. Thanks.
Mr. Christman?
No questions.
Mr. Sanderson?
Nothing further.
Okay. Mr. Hsu?
No, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle?
Nothing, thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Nigam.
And with that, Judge, MDU has no further witnesses and would end our presentation with respect to this application.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Hsu, any witnesses?
Yes, Ryan, we do have one witness. I would just like to call Victor Shook.
Okay.
Do
you want to take
him? I know.
I'm going to check with the commissioners again. You want to keep going, right?
Sure.
Okay. Okay, Mr. Shuck, you were here when I gave the perjury admonition?
Yes.
Okay. Raise your right hand. You promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
Yes, I do.
Thank you.
All right.
Mr. Hsu.
Please state your name for the record.
Victor Shuck.
And are you familiar with these proceedings?
I am.
And are you familiar with the settlement agreement?
Yes.
And do you support the settlement agreement?
I do.
All right. There was some talk earlier about the benefits of using riders as opposed to lumping all these into rate case. Would you speak to that to some degree?
Sure. In my opinion, the whole argument of, you know, is it more appropriate from a customer perspective to employ riders versus forcing rate cases? I guess in my opinion, I do like the rider approach. It kind of creates that fairness between the company and the customer, customer paying for what the company is required to do a little bit closer to the time that they're required to do it. Additionally, I think it actually lowers the cost overall for the customer in the long term, whereby they're not paying, accrued interest charges for a large resource that may come online, but not recovered immediately due to waiting for the results of a full rate case.
And whether there any other benefits too, such as a rate shock or anything like that?
Certainly. I can understand, from Mr. Fedorchak's concern getting calls from customers that, well, you just gave them $2 last month, now there's another $2 this month. I'm sure, that those kind of things are going to be tough to deal with. But in my opinion, and, not everybody's going to agree, but, three times – getting $2, if it's spread out over several months or a year, might be easier to sell and potentially generate fewer phone calls than one $10 to $15 increase.
Mr. Shook, your testimony has been placed in the record. Is there anything else you'd like to add or anything you'd like to change in your testimony?
No.
I turn to the witness, Your Honor.
Okay. Mr. Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Shook. Just real briefly, just so we're clear, advocacy staff believes it's the best interest of ratepayers to accept the settlement agreement it reached with Montana Dakota in this case?
Yes.
I have no further questions. Thank you.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle.
Yeah, I have a few. I won't say a couple. I think it's more than two. And I didn't have any of them like the first three times I read the settlement. It's just been sitting here this morning listening to testimony. So these are kind of questions about your understanding of the settlement. So there's a clear picture of what what would happen now and what would happen at rate case time. Okay, so in the very beginning of the settlement, in the first paragraph, it says that you agree with the company that if it's approved, it would resolve expense, revenue, return, and rate design issues. So a few witnesses back, Jerry and I looked at each other and said, well, is it everyone's understanding that it's not resolving need or prudence issues for Rice, that this settlement, and if the commission adopts the settlement, need and prudence still remain as open issues when the rate case is filed or not? I just need to know what you're thinking.
In my opinion, due to the fact that this is on an interim basis, those would remain questions to be answered in the rate case.
Okay. So, and I understand that the recovery is interim, and so I want to know what would be subject to debate later. And so those would remain subject to being an advocacy staff position one way or another in the rate case.
Yes.
Correct? Okay. My other questions concern the number 4 on page 4. And again, I had to read this 3 or 4 times, and then I had to ask Jerry to read it 3 or 4 times. I think there might be a typo or two in there. There might not be. I might be misunderstanding it. But the sentence that's down about 5 lines, it begins, at that time, the net investment authorized in the rate case for Heskett 3 and Rice will be rolled into rate base. But my first thought was the net investment for Heskett has already been finally determined. It's not in base rates, but it's been finally determined in that case in 2014. Is that not correct? 14-109?
I believe that's correct, yes.
Okay, so that's like a typo perhaps.
Well, I mean, the net investment could be adjusted in any rate case, you know, subject to review at that time, in my opinion. Maybe I'm wrong, but...
Well, I don't honestly know the answer, but it's something that I'd like to know what the parties think. If the net investment, whatever that number was, which I looked at in 14-109, could or couldn't be the investment. I'm not talking about the maintenance or the ongoing operation costs, but the investment number, I don't honestly know. So I'd like to know what the party's position is based on this. Or maybe the settlement could be tweaked to explain it to us, what the two parties think it should mean. So that's a question.
I think the settlement is intended to, you know, encompass the entire generation rider. Advocacy's concerns kind of revolve a little bit more around the Rice because, like you said, the Heskett has already kind of, you know, had its merits and costs reviewed in depth and in detail.
In the other case.
Right.
And we have an order in the other case, correct?
Right.
In the 14-109. Right. Okay. There was a similar question, I think, that was brought up with Commissioner Calk and Ms. Aberle about the elimination of the Generation Resource Recovery Rider. That's the line just before that, which she explained, not eliminating the rider, just eliminating the rates under the rider.
Correct, correct. The tariff would remain in place. The rates would be moved into base rates, and the rider would remain available for future resource additions, kind of along the same lines of what we were talking about, to more closely match when the investment is made.
So I wanted to be sure that you were on the, you know, had the same understanding as she did on that sentence. And then my next area of concern, and perhaps the biggest one, and again, I had to read this several times, but it's the second half of that paragraph, if you have it in front of me.
Can you restate where you're at?
I'm on page 4 of the settlement, number 4.
Okay, thank you.
And that's the next sentence after the rolled in. The return on equity component of the rider and the final investment in Rice as allocated to North Dakota shall be subject to retroactive adjustment to the date interim rates are implemented based on the final determination of an appropriate return on equity and the net investment authorized in the rate case for Rice. So my first question is, I want to be sure that the use of the term interim there and above in the paragraph is talking about the interim rates from this settlement, not the interim rates allowed by law.
Correct.
Okay. But my bigger question is, to me, that sentence permits or is an attempt to permit an increase, not just a decrease, so that it could be that the parties are thinking, or at least one of them might be thinking, that if return on equity and net investment is higher than you are guessing at the time right now or agreeing to at the time, that the rate that you would go back and start collecting it from the beginning of these interim rates that are subject to this settlement and add it, which I think could be illegally, you know, retroactive rate making that's illegal. And I don't know for sure. But the first question is whether that's what staff is contemplating, that that's a possibility. And then the second question is, if so, then I would like the parties to provide something that would explain that whether or not that's legal.
Okay. I guess I can't speak to the legality, obviously, of that, but right. that is my understanding. So while I think the chances of the return on equity component going higher is remote, I certainly recognize there's the possibility for that to happen.
And the investment number that you're working off of could also go higher because it's going to be decided in the rate case.
Sure. Yes. Yes.
Okay. But then the parties are thinking you'd go back to this moment in time. Let's say it was tomorrow that we got this done and add that all back in before you figured out if there was any refund due or whatever.
Correct.
Okay. Those are all my questions. I would ask MDU and advocacy staff to provide some basis for the legality of that kind of an adjustment in a later filing.
Sure.
I don't think it has to be an exhibit. I mean, it's a legal thing.
Lana, can you go back through that whole line of discussion again so I can understand it?
Okay.
Just give me the highlights here.
Well, all it is...
Because I was concerned about interim rates right away.
I know you were.
I'm trying to figure out what exactly you're asking.
Which is why I went back and read it like five more times. Well, my first question was, when they use interim rates in this settlement, they're talking about the interim from this case, not the interim allowed by law, okay? And I wanted to clarify that because everything is going to be calculated that way. There may be other differences in a rate case for interim rates, but as relate to these issues, the parties have confirmed that they're talking about these interim from this case. And then the second half of that paragraph simply says that if return or investment in the rate case end up being more than everybody thinks, you can go back to the beginning of these rates, which let's say it's tomorrow, and add it and figure them out with the higher return and the higher investment and calculate the fact that MDU would then be due money from ratepayers back to the day after today,
do you,
which is, to me, retroactive rate making. That's what I think the sentence says, and Victor's understanding it that way. So that's saying when next year when we figure out the final answer, we can go back a year and collect that from ratepayers. Now, in the statute that allows interim rates, you kind of can do the same thing, but you have a statute that explains you can do it. So that's where I have a problem. I'm not 100% sure, but I think the parties can provide more information on the legality of it. I don't know if that explained it or not.
Thank you.
Well, okay.
These
Jack understands.
Understand.
Jack understands, yeah. Victor understands, so great. Those are my only questions, with what your understanding was as staff. Thank you.
Now I'm going to go to the commissioners.
Can I question my own attorney, Judge?
You can.
Yeah. Swear in. Vic, I don't have a lot of questions other than your testimony, which I had it here somewhere. The last part of your testimony says, why are you agreeing to wait until the rate case to continue the review of these resources? Staff believes it is in the best interest of ratepayers to avoid a duplicate resource review. Okay, so what did you actually do before you signed off on the settlement agreement? You just said, I'll sign it, looks good, I'll worry about it in September?
No. We've had multiple data requests to MDU to try to better understand the costs and the needs for the resource. At the point that we agreed to sign the settlement agreement, we kind of reached a point that we found that there's much more review by someone more capable than staff is to review the costs associated with the resource, and it would take considerable time and require hiring a consultant.
You felt you didn't have the resources to do a full analysis to offer a recommendation, so you signed a settlement agreement?
No. I didn't feel that I didn't have the resources. I felt that it would be more in the best interest of ratepayers before we were signed the settlement agreement for the generation rider, we had already signed a settlement for the renewable rider. In that rider, MDU agreed to file a rate case by September 30th. In that rate case, I would anticipate a full resource review by a consultant at that time. So in my thought process, rather than having this resource reviewed by a consultant now and again in that rate case in September.
Wouldn't it be easier to do it in September if you've already done it now? You'd just be a true up of numbers?
Probably, but I would imagine the bill from the consultant would be the same.
Okay. What is your understanding if the commission rejects this settlement agreement? Then does it go to a hearing, or does it we just wait until September and they file a rate case? What is your understanding if this gets rejected?
If the settlement agreement would get rejected, I suppose it would be up to the commission if they would choose to just accept the application as it was, or require another hearing to hear more details before making a decision. So
what do you think is the harm of the commission rejecting the settlement agreement and rejecting their filing and saying, we'll see you in September?
Potential harm would be some interest compounding on these resources, or on the rice unit resources for the customers. So the net impact of the customers in the long term would be more interest costs.
Okay, so interest costs, so more carrying costs. What else might there be that?
I guess off the top of my head, nothing's coming to mind. I'm sure there's certainly other things, but the cost is generally the thing on the top of my brain when we're talking about
this. And then you heard the company, I think we heard the company say that they were not against, as we get into this rate case, removing the Cedar Hills and Diamond Willows from the base rate discussion and moving it into the renewable rider. Have you have enough to understand that, or not to understand it? Do you have any thoughts about that right now?
I don't know the setup of those two wind farms, or if they're PPAs versus owned situations. On a fundamental level, I like that idea of moving that into the renewable rider, okay, provided it's functionally able to work out.
Thank you, Victor. No other questions.
Commissioner Fedorchak.
Okay, Vic, since we were talking about riders, you think they're a preferred mechanism? It's gathering.
In my opinion, they are.
Then, if they're so positive for the companies and for the customers, why do some states not even allow them? What are the downsides?
I guess the downsides could be, in theory, there could be not as much scrutiny on, resource additions in a rider versus a rate case. I guess that's about it. Outside of if someone would prefer to have one large increase versus the multiple smaller ones, it just depends on your point of view if that's a positive or a negative. That's really all that comes to mind, I guess.
Is it is it curious to you that there's a fair number of states that don't allow riders?
It is. I guess I don't have a reason for why. Haven't really.
All right. Let's see. On the, I have to go back to the discussion that we were having with Lana, and we'll have more discussion with her separately about this. But I think it would be helpful, since I think Commissioner Kalk, and I'm not sure about Commissioner Crispin, but to, can you just walk through this with the real, like, real figures, real numbers? So say we approve this settlement agreement and the I don't know what you're talking about, interim rates. I'm just calling them the rider.
Well,
it goes into effect with its new rate. Is that an interim in some way? Or
it's on an interim basis. So normally
is that the interim rate you're talking about here then?
Yes.
So it's the new revised rider rate. Okay.
Correct. It's just that normally a rider approval wouldn't – you couldn't go back and tweak it a little bit. So what this is doing is – when we come to the result of the rate case, let's say we've reduced the ROE down to, let's go crazy and say 8. This would be recalculated back to when this updated rider goes into effect, and we would say, okay, this is how much you should have collected from customers during that time. You actually collected this, so there's a refund due of X dollars.
Okay.
Normally, so, it would just be, well, that's that time period is over with. We can develop a return going forward, but this provides us that ability to go back.
But to Alana's point, it'll not only be the ROE, it'll be the ROE and the cost.
Correct.
So if the cost went up high and say that number was that the company didn't collect enough through the rider, through the interim rider, we'll just call it the rider.
Yep, rider.
Then they will have the opportunity to charge, to go back and collect more. And then does that number get rolled up into a new rider, or does it get rolled up into whatever the interim rate for the rate increase case, the rate request?
Sure. So
does that get rolled up into that, or is it a new rider number? Plus, then there'll be another line on the bill that says, "Here's your interim rate increase."
I didn't figure out how that scenario would play out. I don't anticipate in any direction that we would want to have this rider in place after the rate case.
Okay.
I would imagine we could design the rate in such a way that that's not necessary. After the rate case, regardless of the outcome.
You anticipated at the time that the rate case is filed and we're considering interim rates, this calculation would be done regarding whether or not there was enough or too much collected through the rider. That calculation will be done, and then either there'll be a refund and then an interim rate, or the refund will be calculated as part of the interim rate, and then that's the interim rate increase until we process the rate case.
I don't think that's how it works. Okay,
so you tell me how it will work.
All right. So this rider is going to be going along. So this rider, if we approve the settlement as we have proposed, this rider will go into place, and it will not change until the end of the rate case.
Okay.
When MDU files a rate case, whatever their interim increase for that rate case is, that would be tracked and calculated separately from this rider.
So there'll be an interim rate. So the rider will stay in place until the end of the rate case.
Mm-hmm.
Then there'll be an interim rate for whatever other additional increases the company's asking for.
Correct. And that would, so there would be an additional, so that by the time we get to the conclusion of the rate case, there will likely be two separate interim class rates in effect that will have to be calculated once we get to the final decision in that rate case.
Okay. I think I understand that now. And we'll find out from you guys how this is legal. All right. Thank you.
Mr. Crispin.
The reduction from 10.75 to 10.5, was that advocacy staff's recommendation, or is that what MDU came in with?
Let's do this,
and then we'll settle, or what?
I generally like to be a little more optimistic. I shot a little lower than that initially. This is where we were able to settle on.
Can you just give me a little explanation of how you settle on that, you know, why it's not 10.35 or 10.6 or something like that?
I guess it's just what both parties are able to agree to. It was a tolerable number given that, you know, we're starting to see a change in the economy in, you know, interest rates and things like that. So while if that had not happened, I would have certainly shot lower. So as a reference, in the last natural gas case we had with MDU, I think we came away with about 9.5, if memory serves. If you look nationally at kind of where natural gas utilities fall and what they're granted for return on equity, 9.5 works very, or falls right in line with about the average nationally for, excuse me, for a natural gas company. If you get that same type of chart for an electric utility, it's closer to the 10 range, or it was for I believe our numbers went through 2014. I don't know if we had anything available for 2015 at that time. But so that's where I would have shot and looked to achieve had there not been a kind of a change in what the Fed is doing with interest rates, which is starting to drive things up and will continue to do so over the next year.
And that agreement saves the ratepayers a little over $191,000, right?
Correct. In just this rider alone. I mean, you know, if we take that into the full rate case on all their resources, it would have a much larger impact.
Okay. No other questions. Thank you.
Okay.
Nothing further, Your Honor.
Mr. Hsu?
Mr. Shook, one benefit of not having riders in place, would you agree that maybe it could lead to regulatory lag?
Certainly.
So, and some states look favorably upon that.
Yes.
And would that require more likely, more frequent rate cases?
Yes, absolutely.
And are more frequent rate cases necessarily a good idea?
Not in my opinion, they are not. They're very costly to the state, both taxpayers and ratepayers.
No further questions, Your Honor.
Hey, Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco.
Yes, unfortunately, Victor. The discussion you just had with Commissioner Fedorchuk about how this would fit in with rate case and interim rates was different than what I heard Ms. Aberle testify to when Commissioner Kalk first asked her that question. And so we're back to the very beginning here. What I understood Ms. Aberle to say is that they were still trying to decide if they would roll it in early on into the interim rate request under the rate case or leave it run separately and have it roll in at the final rate case decision, which is what I heard you saying. You thought it was going to happen that way. The rider would just continue to run and roll in at the end. And I thought I heard Ms. Aberle say that they were still considering what would be the best approach. I may have misunderstood what she said, but I didn't know if you...
I guess I don't recall her exact words, but that wasn't my understanding of what she said. Okay.
I may have to ask her for a minute to explain her answer then.
Okay. Okay, I'm going to go back to you, Mr. Sanderson.
Nothing further.
Okay. All right. Mr. Shook, you can step down. Mr. Hsu, any other witnesses or evidence to present?
No, Your Honor. Okay.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco, any witnesses or evidence to present?
No.
Do you want to recall Ms. Aberle and ask her that question?
If we could, yes. I'd like to know what I was misunderstanding about her answer there.
Mr. Sanderson, any objection to doing it that way?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Ms. Aberle, I just remind you, you're still under oath. Go ahead, Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco.
Well, I think, Tammy, you heard the discussion that Victor had with Commissioner Fedorchuk, and could you just kind of explain to me which is what you testified to originally?
I believe the misunderstanding may have been, I said we had not specifically discussed all of the mechanics of that with staff, but I believe we are on the same page. So I have the same understanding as Victor explained, that the interims, we would need to run through the interims till the end of the rate case because we wouldn't know what those established amounts would be at the time we filed for interim under the rate increase itself.
Okay, thank you.
Any questions for Ms. Aberle? Mr. Sanderson?
Nothing.
Mr. Shue?
Oh, Your Honor.
Commissioners?
Absolutely.
You got to have one.
Okay, Tammy, to make sure I'm completely square. So as we roll into this rate case, the renewable rider will stay into place until we get into the rate case. As we come out of the rate case, we'll have the renewable rider will more than likely, hopefully, have Diamond, Willow, Cedar Hills, and Thunder Spirit will be in the renewable rider.
That is my understanding.
If we can get it all worked out. And as we get into the transmission rider, we go into the rate case, the transmission rider that's in front of us now will have some decision will have been made. But coming out of that rate case, we'll continue to carry the MISO charges in there as well as perhaps the SPP charges will stay in the transmission rider. But the projects that you're the owner of, those two will get rolled into rates in some way, shape, or form.
That's correct.
Okay. The generation rider, coming out of this, there'll be no more generation projects in the generation rider. We'll figure out what that is.
That's correct.
Fair enough. And then, say if we approve this settlement agreement, the Buck 94 will run until the end of the rate case. But then there'll be some amount that you will ask for in interim rates for the rate case above and beyond what is potentially approved in the settlement agreement.
Correct. It would be, I'll say, rate case related.
Yes, absolutely. And at the end of the day, we'll come out with what that number is. It'd be the plus or minus the 194 plus whatever comes out of your interim rates for the rate case. Correct. Fair enough. Thank you, ma'am.
Commissioner Fedorchak?
I don't have any. Thank you.
Commissioner Crisp?
No, sir, I did not.
Hey, anybody else? And Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
No, thank you.
Okay, now do you rest your case then?
Yes.
Okay.
Sorry.
All right. Now, back to you, Mr. Sanderson. Any redirect or any
rebuttal? No further witnesses, Your Honor.
Okay. One thing I do want to do for the record, I don't see anybody out here who I think is not with MDU or the PSC. But just in case there are any member of the public that wants to weigh in on this topic. All right, seeing none, where do we go from here, Mr. Sanderson?
In brief closing, Your Honor, just like to thank the commission for the opportunity to be here in support of this. We would ask that the commission approve the settlement agreement MDU has reached with the advocacy staff. Based on the concerns or some of the comments that were made, we do believe these riders are appropriate. These were facilities that were put in place, are benefiting MDU customers and North Dakota ratepayers at this time. We think the company is entitled to, and the law provides to allow us to recover this on an interim, as was explained. And our intent, these will be rolled into a rate case. There will be more formal determination, and if it's found we've charged too much, 100% will go back to the customers, and if not, it'll be worked out in the rate case. But we believe these riders are an appropriate mechanism to recover the investment we have made for the benefit of North Dakota consumers. And for those reasons, would ask that the commission approve the settlement agreement that we've reached. Thank you for your time.
Mr. Shue, closing remarks?
Just briefly, Your Honor. We do agree that this settlement agreement is in the best interest of all parties and the ratepayers. We do have a couple things we have to clean up, I see. We'll get back to the commission with the legality of, I think, Provision 4. And we also look forward to, even though this is being approved, I do believe we'll have the opportunity with additional resources and higher scrutiny during a rate case to readdress these resource additions and come to what we feel is an appropriate conclusion.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco, concluding remarks?
No, thank you.
Okay. I do want to talk about a briefing schedule, proposed findings of fact, to brief this issue that this legal issue that's come up on whether or not this can be done retroactively. What, Mr. Sanderson, are you willing to put together proposed findings of fact, conclusions of law and order?
We can, Your Honor.
Okay. What timetable? When do you think we can get that done by?
You guys, let's go. 3 weeks.
Okay. 3 weeks from today, so about the 25th of February. And how much time to respond, Mr. Hsu?
Your Honor, I don't anticipate that we'll need to respond. I'll probably end up, if it's all right, Mr. Sanderson, reviewing his and either signing off and having an additional one within the proposed time if we disagree.
Okay, so we could have this completed by February 25th?
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Jeffcoat Sacco? Okay. All right, closing remarks from the commissioners. Commissioner Kalk, do you want to go first since you have the
portfolio? Good online. Just thank MDU for putting this together and Vic for your review of it. Don't take the shots personal about the review of it, because that is one thing I often wonder about, though. We got one person, and they've got all these people here. So I think that's the point of having these rate cases. I think my last discussion line with Tammy was really where I'm at on most of these things. I really like the renewable riders, because then we can track these costs very closely, because as they get older, then that's when they really become the good deal. So you roll those into base rates, that's not quite the visibility we need. The generation rider or the transmission riders, these are things that the three of us really struggle with, I think. Me personally, I do, just because it's so many costs that we can't control that says we all got to be involved in SPP and MISO and OMS and anything we can do to keep those costs down the front end, because they come to us as a bill, where we've talked about that. And the generation rider, I thought it was okay for Heskett, but I really don't like using it in the future. So thank you all for your time.
Mr. Fedorchak.
Well, again, thanks, everybody. Appreciate the opportunity to get more information from all of you and on issues specifically related to this, and also some other technical issues that you heard me ask a lot about the demand response. I think that in the past we haven't been very active in that area, and I view it differently than environmental efficiency. I think those are two separate things. Demand response, in my view, is efforts to incentivize customers off peak and to really curtail that peak. And I know energy efficiency programs can do the same, but I think there's a different philosophy to some of those. The bottom line in this carbon dioxide constrained environment, we have to be getting more serious about all of it. And I think that it can help mitigate some of the rate increases that are coming our way. If we can make better use of all of the fleet that we already own, it can have a very appealing impact on the carbon footprint, and the rates of demand response may be less than rates of new building, especially peakers. So I think those are things that I'll be looking at more, looking to the companies for more technical input, and just really digging into other resources through NARUC, et cetera, and getting smarter about demand response in general. So that's just a preview, I guess, of things to come in that regard. Our last discussion about the rider and the interim rates, et cetera, it was hard for us to even understand it. How in the world are customers going to be able to understand this? We have got to really work to simplify and to make sure we have a clear path moving forward for how we're going to – I recognize all the investments you guys are making. It's huge. It's expansion. It's revitalizing. It's renewable integration. It's related to federal regulations. It's so many things. We're going to have to really be diligent in finding ways to work this all together and communicate it to customers effectively, so they can understand what they're being charged and why, and what they're getting as a result of that. So. Thanks. I think we're going, we made some progress today to that end, and we'll continue that through the rate case. So thank you very much.
Mr. Chrisman.
Well, despite the almost absurd complexity of this, of these issues that were just talked about, this particular case, I thought, I just want to commend the company for presenting it in a pretty clear and concise way, at least as much as it can be. With something this complex, and also our advocacy staff for looking out for the ratepayers and working on a settlement that will save the ratepayers some money if ultimately approved here. So we'll give it a hard look, and that's all the closing comments I have.
Well, from a neutral standpoint, it seems to me that everybody here really knows what they're doing and what they're talking about, and it was a very impressive presentation. Anything I'm forgetting before I close the record? Anything we need to do on the record, Mr. Sanderson?
Nothing from MDU, Your Honor. Thank you.
Mr. Hsu?
Nothing, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeff, you hesitated. Are you sure?
I'm just waiting for the microphone to come on.
Ms. Jeff Kotsako.
Nothing, thanks.
Okay. All right. That being said, I'm going to close the record on case number PU-15-704.